Available on Blu-ray or to rent.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lurie. Well, coming up on the first part of today's show, one of the leading rock journalists in the world, Sylvie Simmons, has interviewed and written about Leonard Cohen, Mick Jagger, Tom Waits, Neil Young, Johnny Cash, and The Clash. Simmons is also a musician. She'll be performing tomorrow night in Tampa, and she'll join us in just a moment. But first, two listener comments about yesterday's program. Yesterday, the topic was taxes, military spending, government priorities, and proposed cuts to domestic programs. Here's what two listeners had to say.
Stephen and St. Pete, I was just listening to the show. If you look at empires, you go back to the ancient empires of the Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks under Alexander the Great, the Roman Empire, and you look at these different empires, their infrastructure deteriorated. They spent way too much of their GDP on military. And in more modern times, you look at the British Empire and the Russian Empire. Why empires come to an end? And the United States today has no national health care. It has no K-20 education system. Its infrastructure is crumbling, and it continues to fanatically spend money on weapons and military systems of weapons that they'll never use. And that was the same problem with the Soviet Union in the arms race with Ronald Reagan. And we are still ruled by Reaganism. No matter who's in the White House, no matter who's the governor of the state that you live in, both parties are ruled by Reaganism.
This is Leo in Tampa calling. Rob, I've done social work for many years, and I have a company that currently works with elderly and disabled people who cannot work. Most of them, on average, are getting about $15 a month for food stamps. That's it, $15 a month. I guess Rick Scott and the rest of the Republicans are running short of money now, so they have to take it from, you know, the very rich, meaning the disabled and the poor.
Well, there you have some listener comments that came in after yesterday's program. The field of rock journalism has long been dominated by men, but our next guest is one of the few women to break through. Since the late 1970s, she's interviewed and written about some of the world's greatest musicians for such publications as The Guardian, Rolling Stone, and Mojo magazine. Her 2012 biography of Leonard Cohen, I'm Your Man, is widely considered the definitive biography of the Canadian singer-songwriter. She's also a musician, and she'll be performing this week in Tampa. And our guest is Sylvie Simmons. Sylvie, welcome to WMNF. Nice to see you. Thank you
nice
for coming by.
Nice to see you, too. Thank you.
You're one of the few women rock journalists. How did you start off as a rock journalist?
By sheer persistence and not realizing that I needed a penis for the job, I guess. I just decided I was one in the time-honored fashion of being a failed musician in my teens. I went on stage with my guitar and sad songs and had stage fright, so I immediately jumped into music journalism.
And that was, what was your first piece? Do you remember what you wrote about the first time?
Yeah, the first real big piece I wrote was on Steely Dan, the album Ager in 1977. Since I didn't get too far in England, they just wanted me to write about the Bay City Rollers and the Osmonds. Remember the Osmonds. And so I went out to L.A., found myself out there, luckily didn't come back again and just stayed. And I happened to be there when they were doing press for an album called Ager.
Mm. And what was it like to be a woman in a field that's dominated by men?
It's one of those weird things that you kind of, being a woman, you don't often think what it's like to be a woman. You just kind of get on with being a woman. Certainly, it was fairly, I think, a bit of a shock sometimes for some of the celebrities. You'd come through, they'd have a whole day of talking to spotty boys with glasses on, your average rock writer. And then there'll be this kind of young person wearing so much eye makeup that, you know, I could hardly keep my eyelids open, with a lot of questions, because I was always a music geek from the second I can remember. Not just learning every lyric, but trying to find out everything I could about them back in the pre-internet days.
Who were your early music heroes?
Of course, the Beatles. I think everybody in England and America, maybe of a certain age, are Beatle damaged. You know, everything there, that my basic kind of default position, really, for everything. And I guess I was about maybe 9 when the Beatles came out, and it was immediate love. And because of that era, the 60s and into the 70s, it was almost like a complete conveyor belt of good music just getting better and better over time. And I was in love with all of it. There was this complete, like, wide open innocence and passion in a way for music.
How does one get to interview a musician, a big star? Like you said, Steely Dan, you've also interviewed Mick Jagger and Tom Waits and Neil Young, and we're going to get to Leonard Cohen in a moment. But how do you do it? You just call them up? What do you do?
Well, it depends what it's going on. Usually what happens is an artist will have a new thing out, and so they want some publicity. And back when I started, it was in England especially, we had four music magazines that came out every week called the Inkies, because it was cheap old paper where it came off in your hand, the ink came off in your hands. And these papers had the ability to make and break musicians, because there was really no radio in England other than pirate radio, which was a ship off in the English Channel.
Because the BBC wasn't playing rock and roll?
No, not at all. There might be one program a week, and they had one TV program a week on rock. So these were very important to musicians, so they had to put up with a bunch of journalists who had kind of come up in what they called the gonzo journalism age. Hunter Thompson had introduced the idea of not having detached journalism. You were part of the story. It was a big kind of ego trip in a way, and some of us would dress like rock stars, especially me. But some of the guys really went for the look and acted like rock stars. So we had much more easy access back then. It was really only in the 80s, when so much huge money was to be made in the business, that there were all these different levels of, you know, endless managers and people getting in the way of you talking to them. But what would usually happen is, as I say, they were going to promote something, so they assumed that if we interviewed them, we would find some sort of magazine or other to run it. And I was lucky in that I became a correspondent very quickly after moving to LA for magazines in England and across the world. And I had also a syndicated radio show. So I was in a very happy position that I didn't have to scramble to get these people. Just an accident of luck and place and time.
Here in the States, we have Rolling Stone and we had Cream and some other magazines. In England, Mojo magazine was one of the big rock magazines.
That came later. I was with Cream for some period as well. I loved writing for Cream. When I was writing for the Cream, it was about the time when it was the sort of heavy metal was starting to come out in America. You know, the people with the exploding hairdos and men in high-heeled shoes and spandex, you know. The good look. I've always thought that should come back sometime. And so I was, I guess, the heavy metal correspondent out there. Mojo didn't start until, I think it was the end of 1993, we did the pilot issue. 1994, I think, was the first issues. And that was a spin-off of a glossy music magazine in England called Q, which was very big. Quite often magazines would find that they, you know, because of all the various genres around, that, you know, they didn't want to have too much of the classic rock in Q anymore. And, you know, they'd always have Sting on the cover or Madonna. And so we kind of had Mojo for the kind of the, you know, the people who grew up on Zeppelin, but not all, and the Beatles, of course, and trying not to always have Beatles on the cover.
Was Mojo a champion of the punk music scene too?
No, not really. No. When I was writing for the Inkies, they were very much champions of that scene.
Yeah.
And that scene was very different in England. I was still in England in 76 when all of those bands were coming up, and it was a very, very young scene. It was a really vital, energetic, and sometimes fairly brutal, you know, quite angry scene. And I remember going to gigs and all the boys would be at the front and knocking each other out, knocking each other over, spitting. There was a lot of spitting for some reason. And all the girls would stand at the back, you know, and enjoy it if they did, you know, if they wanted to. But in America, because in America a lot of clubs were over 21, it became a bit more of a kind of vaguely academic kind of crowd. The music journalists who thought that they should be going to rock clubs and wear sort of tatty weird clothes and with pins in. So it was a very different movement in LA, though they're fantastic in New York with the Ramones and Blondie, etc.
Well, we're talking with Sylvie Simmons, who is one of the leading female rock journalists in the country and in the world. And she's written a lot of books, including a major biography of Leonard Cohen. She's written about Neil Young. And our phone number is 813-239-9663. I want to play the first song that you remember by Leonard Cohen. And we're going to start talking about his biography, the biography that you wrote about him. We're going to play Sisters of Mercy. How did you happen to listen to this song as your first Leonard Cohen song?
Because when I was a kid in England, they started to put out compilation albums. The major labels would gather together various of their bands, and they sent these cheap albums out. They the same price as a 45, a single, which I could afford. So I bought this one that was a Columbia Records one called The Rock Machine Turns You On. and it had Bob Dylan on it, it had Simon and Garfunkel, and it had Leonard Cohen with that song, Sisters of Mercy, that floored me when I heard it.
Mercy, they are not departed or gone. They were waiting for me when I thought that I just can't go on. And they brought me their comfort, and later they brought me this song. Oh, I hope you run into them, you who've been traveling so long.
Well, that's one of the early songs of Leonard Cohen. Is that 1967 about?
It was on the cusp of 67, 68, 31st of December, 1967.
You were much younger than Leonard Cohen. How did you happen to meet Leonard Cohen?
As a music journalist, and initially it was by phone because I was still living in England. And one time I talked to him when he was living in the monastery on Mount Baldy as a Buddhist monk. And then later he came to Britain when he came down from the mountain, and we did a very long 3-day interview in 2001 when he released an album called 10 New Songs. And at that time, I kind of figured in my head I would write a book on him. It just took me a little while to get around to it because I knew it would be a long, hard job.
Was he an outgoing guy?
He is very gracious, very charming, absolutely devoted to whoever is in the room. He'll talk about you, but it's a very clever way of hiding, not talking about himself. So he's a kind of shy, private man, but he is very good at disguising it.
Would you describe Cohen as more a poet than a singer?
It was a combination of both. When I was writing this very long biography, usually there's a sort of sense when you're writing a biography of it being a long railroad track with stations along the way with different things happening. But I became very aware when I was working on this book that this was more a helix, it was a DNA, that everything he was as a child was exactly what he was when he died, pretty much. And so he was both a poet and a novelist, or both. It was the three things, a poet, a novelist, and a songwriter.
Because when I listen to Leonard Cohen, I often think that he's just talking, but he's got this mellifluous voice that turns into a melody. It's more of him speaking often.
It's very interesting. I went to Montreal, where Leonard was born, at the very beginning of the research for the book, and I got to talk to his rabbi, the one who actually taught his bar mitzvah class. So you can imagine this was a very old rabbi, the older rabbi, not the Cohen brothers' old rabbi, even older. And I asked him, I said, did Leonard sing in the choir? And he kind of peered at me from these big bushy eyebrows and he said, Leonard, sing? He said he was a very good talker. So that answers your question. Funny, with Sisters of Mercy, you can hear that he's trying to sing and it's slightly strained. But in the end, he went to that kind of almost like French kind of murmuring voice, which is a bit of a conversation. And you're right, it's very melodic.
I think it's fair to say he was a fantastic dresser. Where did he get that from?
Well, he was born in a suit, he told me. He said that his father was one of the companies that the family owned. It was a very well-to-do family. One of the companies was a high-end suit company. And so when he was a kid, he and one of his friends used to kind of design their own suits and get the people to make them for him.
Yeah, religion imbues all of his life, and it shows up in his songs, sometimes in mysterious ways for folks that don't know. I think the trajectory is his family is very religious, Jewish, and then he goes into Scientology, and then he goes into Buddhism. Talk about that track for a moment. How did the jump from being Jewish to Scientology?
Well, Leonard always said there wasn't a jump. He was Jewish, whatever happened. Even though he was a Buddhist monk, he wrote a poem saying, I am a Jew. It was called, I am a Jew. And so he stayed Jewish, and it was very important to him. He was somebody who wasn't one of the 60s rebels. He really was a very traditional man. The only way in which he rebelled is he didn't take the easy path of, you know, just being the head of one of the family businesses and pocketing some money and writing a few poems. He decided he would make his money only from his art, which was a very interesting approach. When he was living in New York in the late 60s, he had discovered Scientology and investigated it, as he investigated a lot of things, as a way to kind of deal with this clinical depression that he'd had since his late teens. I'd found out from his family that his mother, Leonard's mother, had been institutionalized for depression, so it seemed to be something that was in the family. But Leonard said this depression, it was not the blues. It was suicidal depression. It was waking up every day thinking, what can I do to get through this day? How many drugs, how many women, how many bottles of wine? So I believe at the time that Scientology seemed to be a kind of self-help group to him. It was almost like going to a psychiatrist without a psychiatrist. They had their engrams and their weird, sorry if you're a Scientologist, but I think it's pretty weird, kind of cans on the end of strings where you show your emotions. So he was very cagey talking about it. I'd asked him if he ever went clear. In his song Famous Blue Raincoat, he actually asked the question, did you ever go clear? And I had access to his archives and found a certificate that, yes, he was an operating thetan, but he'd exited very quickly as soon as they kind of came after him and said, hey, you're kind of getting your name in the New York Times now. Will you be one of our celebrities? And it seems to be that Scientology likes their celebrities. And so he kind of got straight out of that. And at that point, pretty much straight away in the early 70s, moved to Zen Buddhism, Rinzai Zen. He called it the Marines of the Zen world because it was very hardcore, not California spa Zen. And after that, when that didn't help him, he'd moved on to Vedanta for, you know, and studied in India with a guru.
Let's listen to Famous Blue Raincoat right now, where he does mention going clear. Who's he talking to in this when he says...
Well, everybody kind of claims that they're the person that they were talking to. It's interesting. It's another man who he thinks has run off with his girl. This was a man who was probably one of the greatest ladies' men you can think of the 20th century. And he always thinks that somebody else is cuckolding him.
Let's listen to Famous Blue Raincoat, Leonard Cohen.
It's 4 in the morning, the end of December. I'm writing you now just to see if you're better. New York is cold, but I like where I'm living. There's music on Clinton Street all through the evening. I hear that you're building your little house deep in the desert. You're living for nothing now. I hope you're keeping some kind of record. Yes, and Jane came by with a lock of your hair. She said that you gave it to her that night that you planned to go clear. Did you ever go clear? Oh, the last time we saw you, you looked so much older. Your famous blue raincoat was torn at the shoulder. You'd been to the station to meet every train. Then you came home without Lily Marlene. And you treated...
Leonard Cohen, Famous Blue Raincoat. We're talking with Sylvia Simmons, who has written the, perhaps, definitive biography of Leonard Cohen, I'm Your Man. She's widely considered to be one of the top rock journalists in the world, and certainly one of the top female rock journalists. And our phone number here at WMNF is 813-239-9663. Quite a ladies' man.
Yes.
Wrote about women and his loves all the time.
Mm-hmm.
The first song I think a lot of people heard from Leonard Cohen was Suzanne. Was that about one of his lovers?
Yes, in fact, he was had a partnership that was a marriage, in effect, with a Suzanne and had two children with her. But the first Suzanne was a dancer who lived in Montreal. Yeah.
That's where he was born and grew up.
Yeah. That's right, yes.
Yeah. Let's listen to a little bit of Suzanne.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to 88.5 FM.
Suzanne takes you down to her place near the river. You can hear the boats go by. You can spend the night beside her. And you know that she's half crazy, but that's why you wanna be there. And she feeds you tea and oranges that come all the way from China. And just when you mean to tell her that you have no love to give her, then she gets you on her wavelength, and she lets the river answer that you've always been her lover. And you want to travel with her, and you want to travel blind, and you know that she will trust you, for you've touched her perfect body with your mind. And Jesus was a sailor when he walked upon the water, and he spent a long time watching from his lonely wooden tower. And when he knew for certain only drowning men could see him, he said, all men will be sailors then until the sea shall free them. But he himself was broken long before the sky would open. Forsaken, almost human, he sank beneath your wisdom like a stone. You want to travel with him, and you want to travel blind, and you think maybe you'll trust him, for he's touched your perfect body with his mind.
Well, that's Suzanne by Leonard Cohen, and our guest wrote the 2012 biography of Leonard Cohen, I'm Your Man. Our guest is Sylvia Simmons. She's live in the studio, and our phone number is 813-239-9663. It's interesting that he's mixing this idea of seduction by women and seduction by religion.
That's always been a mix right from the beginning to the end with him.
Yeah. You said that he was a pretty straight guy. He was in Cuba, though, during the Bay of Pigs. What was he doing in Cuba during the Bay of Pigs?
Well, as he said, it's a kind of very crazy man thing that he did, an escapade and an adventure. He'd always, interestingly, for being such a sweet lover, you know, kind of a lover more than anything else, he was very interested in the military. His father had been one of the first Jewish officers to serve for Canada in the First World War, and his father died when Leonard was 9 years old, and Leonard was obsessed with a gun that his father kept in the drawer. And he'd always asked his father if he could go to military academy when he was of age. When his father died, clearly the mother wasn't having any of that, so he didn't go. So at various points in his life, he sort of followed these strange little adventures. He also offered himself to fight for Israel in a war at one point, and they quite, you know, sensibly packed him off to play guitar to the troops, and that was good enough.
Yet later on, there's a song that I always remember that's a little bit obscure. It's called The Captain, which I think it sounds like an anti-war, anti-imperialist protest song.
Well, if you listen to Story of Isaac, it's also an anti-war song. So Leonard was full of contradictions right from the beginning. You'd mentioned he was a ladies' man, but yes, he loved them horizontally, but also vertically and every other angle between. He had them as his sound engineer, his music engineer. Very rare to do that. He, up until his last album where he sang himself back home, he had women singing with him. He really would have rather they sang everything for him. So he had women working for him. His managers were women. His first manager and his last manager were both women.
But did he treat them fairly? Did he treat them equally?
Absolutely, completely, graciously and generously.
But he had at least five major women in his life in addition to...
A week,
okay.
Maybe a day. I don't want to kind of put the guy down.
Well, our phone number is 813-239-9663. And David writes this: I was wondering about your guest take on Leonard Cohen as a singer and performer. He was a better writer than singer, in my opinion. And he's sort of like Bob Dylan, writes David. How would you compare Cohen to Dylan?
That's a boy thing. I tend not to do those kind of lists and have one above the other. The two of them are way up at the top of the pantheon as far as lyrical writing and actually songwriting as well. I mean, Leonard, if you think about it, has some great melodies in those early songs that, you know, they really are memorable, beautiful, soaring melodies that give a lot of space for people to inhabit the song and cover it. Sure, in the beginning, his voice was an acquired taste to many people. It seemed that women liked him more than men, and men would buy the album when I was in my teens to try and, you know, seduce a girl because they all liked Leonard Cohen. So they'd play this stuff even though they couldn't stand it. I think he found his voice in that, as I say, like the French chanteur kind of way at the end, where he was more just delivering the words of it. So you're right, the words are magnificent, and so he's definitely more of a lyricist than a standard singer. But hey, Frank Sinatra didn't write his songs, did he?
One of the famous stories in Leonard Cohen's life is that he stopped a riot at the Isle of Wight Festival. How did he do that?
But, mostly because he was on Quaaludes in a huge amount. I don't know if Americans know Quaaludes. This is what kept the English alive back in my teens. And it was, I guess, a kind of, it was just the sort of thing that sort of would knock you out, make you sleepy and everything. Actually, it was called Mandrax back then. I think you guys called it Quaaludes. I sometimes muddle my English and my American. And so he was really, really, really stoned, went on at 2 a.m. and sang just so slowly and hypnotically that the crowd just cooled down. This was after they'd thrown firecrackers and set the stage on fire during Jimi Hendrix's set. So it was a kind of mini Woodstock situation in which a concert on a little tiny, sort of respectable holiday island in England was taken over by far more hippies than they thought would turn up. And they demanded that it be a free concert. So there was a certain amount of contentiousness going on. But something in Leonard's kind of attitude, and also the fact that I'd found in his archives a book of hypnotism, how to hypnotize, you know, people, animals, and a crowd. And I think he'd read the whole book. He was a very hypnotic, mesmerizing person.
So did you ever feel like you were being hypnotized by Leonard Cohen?
No, except that when I did that a three-day interview with him in London, at the end of it, I realized he'd sort of done that. Everybody comes out of an interview with Leonard, be they male or female, with like a sort of little blush in their cheeks and smoking an imaginary cigarette, because he is very seductive and attentive and so articulate. He speaks with the precision of a poet or a politician, you know, just to hide as well as give you information.
So after that 3 days, did you feel like he revealed a whole lot about himself?
He revealed a lot, but not enough. And that was why I decided at that point I would write a book. And Leonard was also very generous about a book I had written that came out that year. He had a copy, and it was a biography I wrote of a French man who in a way was a little like a kind of French Cohen. And his name was Serge Gainsbourg. And he said to me, I wish somebody would write a book like that about me after I'm dead. I just jumped the gun.
You jumped the gun. You started to write before he died. He died last year, but you started to write it in 2010?
I started writing it about then, yes. I can't remember the date. I remember he'd had this remarkable comeback that was forced upon him. While Leonard was living as a monk, his manager somehow managed to empty his bank accounts and his retirement account, and he was pretty much wiped out. And all he could do to pay the bills and to pay the IRS, because the money had been taken from a retirement account, was to go back on the road. And this at the age of 70, after 15 years not going on the road.
Why did he go into the monastery in the first place? Because he was a musician. When you say monastery, are you saying that he gave up everything? He gave up his music and gave up his lifestyle to go in a monastery?
Yep. He went up and lived on Mount Bordy, and I felt it was my duty, you know, due diligence, to go everywhere that Leonard had gone. So when he was living in the Chelsea Hotel, of course, I'd have to go to the Chelsea Hotel and stay there. And I stayed up at that monastery, and I got in touch with Leonard, and I said, I'm going to go to hell. I just stole a spoon from the hall, and I'm digging an escape tunnel. How did you stay 5.5 years? It was the most miserable, unromantic monastery you can imagine, way halfway up Mount Baldy and above the snow line. It was pretty brutal staying in this sort of little hut up there in the cold.
Was there heat or...
No, it was very, very basic with very, very long hours of doing, you know, sort of meditations and chants and walking and jobs. You have to do work as well. But he went up there because he'd sort of had enough. He was always very conflicted about the music business. He had a feeling that going on stage and singing the same old song every night was somehow prostituting his art. So he didn't like doing that. He was also very shy as a performer, and he'd have to drink a lot to get in that, you know, mood to go and play. So he gave that up. At that time, he was also engaged to be married to a beautiful, much younger actress, Rebecca de Mornay. So he decided to give up, I guess, the life of, you know, with women, though there were nuns, as he pointed out, in the monastery, and I'm sure they became friends, and give up the idea of being married and having a music career. And at the age of 60, he moved in with Roshi, his teacher and friend from the early 70s, and was basically his servant for 5.5 years.
Wait a minute, what happened to Rebecca? Good morning.
I asked her. I finally tracked her down, and she gave me the whole stuff on it. She said, well, here's the thing with Leonard. If you think about it, he's never really committed to being a musician. You know, he'd given up the stage for 15 years, you know, at one point later. And she said, he's never really committed to, he's never married anybody. And in the end, he decided to commit to being a Buddhist monk. And so she said, you know, I'm not mad at him because he was always honest and straightforward. And he said to her at one point when they were engaged, you should have children. And she said, like, me? I mean, not us. And he said, oh, no, I've done with my evolutionary bit. You know, my duty is over. I've got my two kids. And so they parted as very close friends. And she came to the family memorial. So clearly there was still love there at the end.
Did he leave the monastery because of the finding out that he had money trouble, that he had been ripped off by his manager?
No, and he'd led me to believe that he'd left because he was over depression. And it wasn't that at all. He told me he left because he was so expletive deleted depressed that he couldn't stay there another minute. So 5.5 years later, he left, and he went to India and studied with a guru out there studying Vedanta. And he said that that was what cured him of depression at the age of 70. It was that long. But he said his guru in India, Ramesh, said, hey, you had 30 years with Roshi, so you had pretty good training in it. And he said, maybe it's age, who knows. But one day he woke up and looked out his window in the morning and saw the sun glinting on the top of a car, and he felt really happy at the beauty of it. And usually when he'd get up, it's like I said, how do I get through this day? And he was very nervous about talking about the depression and the cure because, as he said, you know, my mom said, don't look a gift horse in the mouth, you know, don't mess with it. It may go away.
Well, our guest is Sylvie Simmons. She is the author of the 2012 biography of Leonard Cohen, which is called I'm Your Man. It's widely considered to be the definitive biography of Leonard Cohen. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. He had a big hit with Suzanne early on, and then he was played on progressive radio, but he wasn't really played on top 40 radio in the country. And then the song Alleluia makes it into a movie after it's been out for years, and it becomes a big hit. Just talk about the song Alleluia. What did Leonard Cohen think about it?
Well, actually, it's a bit more complicated than you said. Leonard had a huge career in the UK, where I'm from, and in Europe. All of those albums that did nothing at all in America, they were getting to number one in the charts, two in the charts. The darker the album, the higher up the charts they seemed to go in the Church of Leonard around Europe. And in America, he didn't really have any hits until 1988 with I'm Your Man came out, that album, and following with The Future. So he did kind of come back at that stage, but actually Alleluia was on an album called Various Positions that was not even released by his record label in America. Famously, the head of the record company said, we know you're great, but this isn't any good. We can't hear a hit on it, you know? And this was the album with Alleluia on it. So he had to put it out a year later in America on an indie label. it was really quite humiliating. So Alleluia kind of sort of had its resurrection much later in a very strange way, where it's now like a kind of vocal workout on every talent show that there is. And and Leonard got to the point where he was saying, can there be a moratorium on covers? Because, boy, that song took the steroids. Everybody on earth, probably at least somebody in this room, has covered it right now. Not me. I was told not to, so I behaved myself.
When I saw him a few years ago, I saw him about 6 or 7 years ago in Tampa. He did perform it.
Oh, he performs, but yeah. It's just the idea that it's become this kind of secular hymn for the 20th-21st century. And I think that was a little shock to him. You know, if you think about it, the strange words don't really lead themselves to that kind of coverage. On the other hand, people often have Dance Me to the End of Love as their wedding song, and it's about the Holocaust. So go figure.
Let's listen to Alleluia from Leonard Cohen.
Now I've heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do you? It goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall, the major lift, the baffled.
Leonard Cohen. We're talking with Leonard Cohen's biographer, Sylvia Simmons, here on WMNF in Tampa. So he comes out of the Buddhist monastery. He has written these great songs, but he's penniless.
Mm-hmm.
And what does he do?
Well, there's not much he could do. He clearly got himself some lawyers, and they looked into it and scratched their heads, and they added even more money to the money that he owed to the world. And finally, this Englishman, who was a promoter and a huge Leonard Cohen fan. Like I said, the British, you know, we've worshipped him forever, came along and offered him a kind of, well, I guess gave him an offer he couldn't refuse at that point, which was to give him a considerable sum of money in the six figures to kind of rehearse and at the end of it, see if he would come on a tour. If he didn't want to, he wouldn't have to pay the guy back. And so Leonard, being a guy of integrity, went through it. And I remember talking to his bandmates and they said they'd get different words from him every time, saying, I'm 60% sure I'm going to do the tour. I'm 20% sure. I'm 90%. And finally, he kind of limped out there wondering if there was anyone to meet him. And he was met by a wave, almost a tsunami of love and respect. And that continued right to his very last days.
You know, when I saw him, there was no indication that he was sick, even though I saw him when he was in his 70s. But he looked great. And he performed for 3 hours at the Straz Center here in Tampa. It was incredible.
3 hours plus 2 hours doing a sound check. He's such a perfectionist that he had to get it exactly right. So those poor, exhausted musicians were playing sometimes every night. But he loved it. I remember I saw him just after the initial first tour ended in December 2010 in, of all places, Las Vegas. And I was back at his home and I just realized, you miss it, don't you? And he knew exactly what I meant. He said, the life of the road, yes. I miss the people. I miss the discipline. I miss knowing what to do, having a function in the world.
And he wasn't sick during those last two tours that he did.
No, he wasn't. It was towards the end of his life.
What happened at the end of his life?
We had compression fractures of the spine. I guess all of that falling to his knees and dancing on stage was a little much for his old body. He's a very kind of thin, frail man. You know, he sort of was very much an ascetic, you know. But also he had leukemia.
Mm. And he died in Los Angeles?
Yeah, he died at his home, in his bed at Los Angeles.
Yeah. Sylvie, you said you went into music writing because you were always wanted to be a musician.
Yep.
You eventually learned how to become a musician.
Yes, I did. And I always thank Leonard Cohen because at the end, when the book came out, you know, when you're a writer, it seems like a glamorous life, but mostly you're within four walls, staring at the wall and sort of hunched over a computer keyboard. So I was ready to go out on the road. And of course, these days, publishers or my publisher had no interest in setting up any book tours, you know. So I thought, oh dear. And my musician friends would say, hey, look, come and do the record shop in our town or our bookshop, and we can come with you. You can bring your ukulele and sing a Leonard Cohen song or two. So I think there's a video online of me doing the first one in LA, and I'm looking so shy and nervous, you know, and doing it. And so after that, I guess gradually after about a year of going around the world, getting from bookshops to actually big stages, the stage fright I had disappeared, so I decided to come out with my own songs, and I got a record deal by some complete luck, and here I am, complete diva.
Well, you're going to be performing tomorrow night at the Attic in Ybor City. Let's hear one of your songs. I picked, I believe it's called In Your Arms.
You Are In My Arms.
You Are In My Arms. You want to set this up, or should I just play it?
Oh, this was recorded live to tape. I was in the studio with a fantastic man called Hal Gelb from Giant Sand, who are, again, much loved in the UK and live in Tucson. And I was getting a little sad sitting in my back room, you know, with a glass cage, which the vocalist is in. I said, can we do one around the piano? And, of course, the engineer nearly freaked out because I play a ukulele, which is quiet, and my voice isn't very loud without a microphone. But we all sat around, and I think the producer, it starts with the producer counting us in, and we did this together around a piano.
Here's now musician Sylvia Simmons, who's also the biographer of Leonard Cohen, and she'll be performing tomorrow night at the Attic in Ybor City.
Up in the sky tonight, and I have wished on everyone. The air is sweet and warm, the waves caress the shore, and the tears in my joy, 'cause you are in.
to pay any mind. There's just you and me in this sweet reverie, where we can stay forever and all time.
Arms by our guest Sylvia Simmons. She's one of the leading rock journalists in the world, having interviewed Leonard Cohen, Mick Jagger, Tom Waits, Neil Young, Johnny Cash, The Clash, and hundreds more, and she'll be performing tomorrow night at The Attic. She's the opening act at The Attic in Ybor City. Sylvia, you also did a tour in which you went around the country doing Leonard Cohen songs. Could you play us a bit of a Leonard Cohen song, if I could impose a little bit on your ukulele?
If my uke is in tune.
Okay. The humidity down here is hell on instruments, although the humidity is not too bad right now.
This is one you played earlier, so you could all say she's no Leonard Cohen. Suzanne takes you down to her place near the river. You can hear the boats go by. You can spend the night beside her. And you know that she's half crazy. That's why you wanna be there. And she feeds you tea and oranges that come all the way from China. And just when you mean to tell her you have no love to give her, and she gets you on her wavelength and lets the river answer that you've always been her lover. And you want to travel with her, and you want to travel blind, and you know that she will trust you, for you've touched her perfect body with her mind.
Wow, wow. Sylvia Simmons is our guest, and we're getting some email questions. Our phone number is 813-239-9663, and our email address is dj@wmnf.org. And let me read some of these emails that have come in. Some people are just saying awesome, and big fan of Sylvia in South Tampa, they say. And Adam writes this, can you ask your guest for a crazy story from one of the artists? Who's the most famous artist she's ever interviewed? And is there someone she didn't get to interview that she wanted to interview?
Good questions. Pretty much, I mean, it's again one of those things, it's a bit of an arm wrestling match between who's the most famous, because I've managed to interview pretty much every big name that I've wanted to. The one that got away was Bob Dylan. Never interviewed Bob Dylan. And
he doesn't grant many interviews, though, does he?
He doesn't. And when he does, at least before the Martin Scorsese film came out, if you're a Dylan fan and you watched that, you must have done if you're a Dylan fan. Like me, you probably sat there with your jaw just dropping further and further towards the floor that Dylan spoke at length, actually articulately without weirdness. There was no kind of strange surrealism going on. He was answering questions and speaking with such enthusiasm and almost graciousness about the music that influenced him and that he loved. But in the past, he would give you something like a 15-minute interview. Now, with Leonard Cohen for that article I did for Mojo, that was probably a 9-hour interview. Other times it might be 2 or 3 hours to do a good feature. With a few minutes, all you get is nothing. You get fluff. So I turned down that interview because he was demanding, or his people were demanding, a cover story on the strength of nothing. So he still eludes me. Maybe now I'll get to speak to him. Some of the most famous, I guess one of the most famous for me was Johnny Cash. I'd interviewed him in the past, but Rick Rubin, who was his producer for the last 10 years of his life, Cohen's, I get them all muddled up, Johnny Cash's life, had had sort of wanted to do a 10-year anniversary book and box set. So he sent me to speak to Johnny Cash. This was 6 weeks after June Carter died, his wife, and 6 weeks before Johnny died. He was terribly, terribly, terribly ill. But he wanted to keep working. It was the only way, he said, that he'd get through this absolute pain of losing.
What surprised June. You most about interviewing Johnny Cash? What did you... Give us just a takeaway from the Johnny Cash interviews.
Well, I recognized it wasn't surprising. He was very much a man's man. And I think it took him a little while to sort of open up to a woman, though, as his housekeeper at the time said, he liked having me around because I was like June. I just kept wittering on, and it was kind of comforting to hear a voice talking about nothing in particular. So that's a good compliment, especially if you get paid by the word. Wittering is a very good thing to do. But what I loved about him was, I think one of the interesting things was he was talking about his relationship with God. Every now and then as a journalist, you don't lob softballs. You want to sort of scratch under the surface. And here I am thinking, you know, June has gone. The great irony, June kept him alive. Johnny was in and out of hospital for years with pneumonia that was one of the side results of autonomic neuropathy, one of the problems he had been suffering from. And June would have these prayer-a-thons that kept Johnny alive. Then June went in for a routine, like, procedure or examination, and she died. And so, like, okay, how do you feel about that with your God? What do you say? And he just looked at me and gave me this real Johnny Cash look, one of those that probably would have stilled me in my tracks if he wasn't in a wheelchair and looked like he'd been 10 rounds with Ali in a match. He looked so beaten up and broken, that poor man. But he said, my arms are too short to box with God. So I guess God was still there, and he was working on a book of hymns, his mother's hymn book it was called, and I'd hear him doing that in the afternoon. So there wasn't too much surprising other than just to see this man that was such a, like a mountain in a way, you know, almost you expect him to be carved into a mountain after he died. And just to see him in a wheelchair so broken but still dressed all in black and able to flip the bird. I was on the receiving end of a bird flip.
You wrote the Leonard Cohen book. You wrote a book about Neil Young. What's your next project?
I'm actually working right now with a woman. For heaven's sake, I'm servant to all of these men, presenting them to the world. I'm working with Debbie Harry of Blondie. We've pretty much nearly finished a book, and it's a kind of a memoir dash autobiography dash all sorts of other things. Hasn't quite fallen into one genre yet. And she came to my show in New York. She said she was going to throw eggs at me. I said, I'll sing a Blondie song if you do that. Neither of us did. We had a kind of showdown, and it came to nothing, as should happen in politics.
Well, I hope you come back when that book comes out.
I hope so too.
Sylvia Simmons, thanks a lot. Sylvia will be performing tomorrow night at the Attic in Ybor City. She's the opening act. I think the festivities get underway.
Yes, Steve Everett and Paul Fowle are headlining, and so I think I'll probably go on at 8:00. So if you make it there, come up and say hi, please.
Will you tell a Leonard Cohen story?
Yeah.
Sylvia, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You're listening to 88.5 FM. This is WMNF in Tampa.
Let me see your beauty. Let me feel you moving like they do in Babylon. Show me slowly what I only know the limits of, and dance me to the end of love. Dance me to the end of love. Above and dance me to the end of love. Dance me to the end of love. Dance me to the children who are asking to be born. Dance me through the curtains that our kisses have outworn.
sense of shelter now. Lord,